Hello. On this week's program, we speak with artistic director Robert Driver about the Opera Company Philadelphia's season finale, the company premiere of Gluck's rarely performed Orfeo e Euridice. Susan Lewis explores Late Renoir, a new Philadelphia Museum of Art exhibition of work from the last decades of the artist's life. David Patrick Stearns profiles pianist Hao Chen Zhang, who opens the Philadelphia Orchestra's Mann Center season on Tuesday. The low-key 20-year-old Curtis student won last year's Van Cliburn piano competition. And in the second part of our Wicked Philadelphia series, Tom Keels tells the story of the 19th century occultist George Lepard. That's all I had this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
So our first item this morning takes us out of the studio and to the Opera Company of Philadelphia, and with me is Artistic Director Robert Driver.
Good morning.
So, lest we think that anybody doesn't know the legend of Orpheus and Eurydice, at their wedding she steps on a snake, is fatally bitten. She goes to the underworld, he follows her there, is allowed to take her back on condition that he lead, she follow, and he not look back.
Right.
They get to the overworld, he looks back, she's gone forever. That's what happens in the legend. Is that what happens on the stage?
Yes. Yes, indeed, it is. And, of course, there is this final scene, which I'm calling an epilogue, in which you have the Amor returning and saying the gods have been moved by his emotions and his constancy and restores Eurydice to him. And I find that doesn't work, you know, that suddenly everything is going to be made all right by
it was all just a dream.
Yes. Well, now you've hit the actual magic word. I think that this works well as a dream, that the whole thing is a dream. And you start with Orpheus at the grave, and you end with Orpheus at the grave, and everything that happens in between. Because I think that if you look at the fourth act, which is the pivotal act where he actually is trying to lead her from the underworld back to the living world, well, he knows it's impossible, and yet he has to accomplish this. And, of course, going from the underworld to the real world is also a stretch, right? I think that can best happen in one's imagination and dreams. So, and I think the eternity, of course, is a cycle of life and death, and I think that's what this piece is about, the fascination with death, and man's always trying to avoid it and evade it and keep it at bay, but no one's done that yet.
Let's talk about the music. Gluck wrote two versions of this.
Yes.
Berlioz goes back, the master orchestrator goes back and makes the best of the two of them.
Exactly. I think Berlioz took from the second version, the Paris version, which was done 10 years later, and of course has a lot of dance and things, which I think that Berlioz took it and kept it organic so that the dance wasn't then a plug-in, which was so much a part of what's happened in opera in Paris, of course. Whether it's Wagner, whoever it is, Verdi, Wagner, when you go to Paris, you got to put in the dance, right? And in this case, this is one of the things I think we're the proudest of, is that the soloists and the chorus and the dancers, it is one group. This you don't have a separate dance. Yes, dancers dance separately, but dancers also dance with the chorus. They dance with Orfeo. It is one body. It's not separate entities, you know, and it's very fluid.
It's beautiful music. Why is it so underperformed?
I don't know. I think that it might be just the fact that, you know, here is a piece of very early music, 18th century music, and today's tastes are different. But I think that that's what people will find. It is one gorgeous flowing melody, which people will recognize, of course. They may not know that it's Orfeo. Of course, the famous aria, J'ai perdu Eurydice, you know, is very famous, and people will recognize that right away. But throughout the opera, and for example, the music of Eurydice, which was put in the Paris version, is also just beautiful. But I mean, there's eight measures in the last act that I just find the most sublime in the opera, you know. It's just a little segment there, and it is gorgeous. And all of us in working on it think, oh my gosh, this music is so, it transports you to another place. It really does.
Opera Company of Philadelphia Artistic Director Robert Driver. The company will present 5 performances of Gluck's Orfeo e Euridice at the Parliament Theatre at the Kimmel Centre beginning Thursday.
Listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The French Impressionist Pierre-Auguste Renoir worked until his death in 1919 and was regarded as one of the greatest artists of his time. Although the modern art world of the mid-20th century embraced other masters, a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art makes the case that Renoir's work during his last 3 decades is among his finest and was a model for the generation that would follow. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers late Renoir.
The exhibition begins with an oil portrait of 2 well-dressed girls, eyes downcast, huddled outdoors around 1 book, reading. The painting, with its simple subject, its complex use of colors, the pale fluid strokes of the skin, the brilliant whites and orangey yellows of the dresses and hats, green and brown brushstrokes suggesting foliage, and its sunny, serene mood, sets the tone for the entire show, says Joseph Rischel, the Philadelphia Museum's curator of European painting before 1900.
It's the celebration of just contentment, beauty, serenity, and timelessness, but completely contemporary timelessness in this case.
Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb says during the last decades of his life, Renoir had critical success that many people today don't fully appreciate.
He was considered in the 1890s, in the first several decades of the 20th century, to be one of the great living artists, and one of the most significant figures that came out of Impressionism and built upon it later in his career.
The museum's associate curator of European painting before 1900, Jennifer Thompson, says Renoir was also influencing the future of art.
All of these younger artists, such as Picasso and Matisse, Bonnard, were all very, very aware of what Renoir was doing because he was still continuing to exhibit works in Paris and to show them additionally in New York and in Venice and elsewhere. So he was a very active figure in the art world, but was this immense, almost father figure to many of these artists.
And yet, many of the works from his late period received little scholarly attention. Mid-20th century critics didn't quite know where to place him in an age of modernism that embraced edgy, anxious works, says Rischel.
In Renoir, what you see is what you get. Perhaps it was his just forthright optimism that just got any card-carrying existentialist really cross.
This new show has, as a consequence, yielded some great discoveries, says Thompson.
They're paintings that we didn't know existed or that have been lost or hadn't been seen since the 1920s that have emerged. So there'll be several works in this exhibition that probably haven't been on public view for 70, 80 years.
This exhibition of Renoir's, interspersed with a few works of Picasso and Matisse, among others, doesn't start until 1980, by which point Renoir's art was infused with a personal and artistic history. Born in 1841, as a young man, he worked in a porcelain factory, drawing designs on fine china and ornamental artwork, and frequented the Louvre, where he studied the works of master painters. He became famous in 1874 as one of the French Impressionists, who bucked convention with works of quick brushstrokes of color to capture fleeting impressions. But by the early 80s, says Joe Rischel, Renoir started to question this way of painting after he went to Italy for the first time.
And he sees Raphael in Rome, the great, stately, for all ages, standing, solid figures, beautifully drawn, and he looks at fresco paintings and really has a kind of life crisis, a midlife crisis.
He rediscovered drawing and made classical-style paintings with very precise outlines, an example of which is his 1887 work, The Large Bathers, part of the Philadelphia Museum of Art's permanent collection. Renoir, says Timothy Rubb, like many successful artists as they age, wanted to leave a lasting legacy.
He wanted to create an art that he felt that would be enduring, that wouldn't be transitory, that would really be about as much about a relationship with the history of art, with the past, as it was with his own time. And so it's not surprising to find classical subjects entering into his work.
In 1890, when Renoir was nearly 50 years old, he married Aline Charago, the mother of his 5-year-old son, with whom he later had 2 more children. When he was in his mid-60s, he bought a house in the south of France. But his embracing of family life was not retirement, nor did he let his rheumatoid arthritis get in the way of his work. But his art took on a new look.
He comes through this remarkable synthesis of this deep saturation in Mediterranean antiquities with mythology, the celebration of the human nude, while regaining some of the sort of blithe spirit, everything loosens up. And this carries him for the last, 29 years of his life, into a high energy phase.
In work that was both classical and experimental, personal and universal, Renoir used as subjects his friends, family, and the world around him. And his use of color, always distinctive, developed even further.
His brushwork, his handling of colors, choice of colors, and the way they are mixed together become even more sophisticated, subtle, and complex. The interweaving of colors and the skill of the brushwork, they feel like tapestries. Nobody painted like Renoir did in that respect.
He is so in love with color, so in love with looking at flesh and the way of painting flesh. And he just seems to get the paint thinner and thinner, that it will run from just the slightest little glaze with a highlight of white and then down again with a kind of lucidity and a transparency that is just one of the most sensual things in the world.
Throughout his life, he kept working, despite ailments and rumors that he could no longer paint.
And so he'd fire back by painting these enormous canvases, I mean, just basically life-size canvases, which were extraordinary when you think that he is, in fact, confined to a wheelchair. And he had this special sort of trestle system built up so that his wheelchair could be sort of raised or lowered so that he could work on the canvas.
The exhibition includes sculpture, which Renoir took up in 1907 at the age of 66. He later worked with sculptor Richard Guinot when his frailty prevented him from physically molding the clay himself. His wife died in 1915 after visiting a son injured in World War I. Curator Jennifer Thompson says when faced with calamity, Renoir turned to his art.
Matisse asked Renoir at one point, "Why do you keep pushing yourself to paint every day? You're obviously in incredible pain." And Renoir responded to Matisse. He said, "The pain passes, but the beauty remains."
At the end of the exhibition is Renoir's last painting. The Bathers is a large work depicting nude women lounging in the Mediterranean outdoors. Matisse watched him paint it and proclaimed it to be Renoir's masterpiece and one of the most beautiful pictures ever painted. Classic-looking, full-bodied figures looking perfectly relaxed in what could be an impressionist landscape. Multiple colors applied in a variety of brush styles invite looking and defy categorization. Perhaps this work makes the case most strongly that Renoir's genius continued to the end.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Late Renoir at the Philadelphia Museum of Art opens Thursday and runs through September 6th. Van Cliburn International Piano Competition winners are no strangers to Philadelphia Orchestra concerts, but not often do they come from Philadelphia's own backyard, inasmuch as the Curtis Institute of Music is anybody's backyard. Chinese pianist Hao Chen Zhang, who opens the orchestra's Mann Center season on Tuesday, was the surprise first-place tie in the 2009 competition, becoming the youngest winner in the competition's history, and with surprisingly non-competition-like repertoire. During an hour spent with him at the Curtis Institute, the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered an astoundingly calm personality behind these unprecedented achievements.
Hao Chen Zhang is in the curious position of having won the career-making Van Cliburn competition, but still feels he has a lot of schoolwork to do. 3 years' worth, in fact. That's how long he plans to stay at the Curtis Institute. He could graduate now with an artist diploma, but would rather earn his bachelor's degree in between some 50 to 70 engagements a year as part of the prize he won in Fort Worth, Texas last year. Staying at school isn't necessarily a matter of learning more repertoire. He knows something close to 50 concertos. And it's not the career pressure, because for him, there's next to none. This lanky, amiable 20-year-old guy from Shanghai says he was never more calm than when he was playing that crucial final round.
The key to get over pressure is, very ironically, by just thinking about music. People say competitions makes music not music, makes music an unmusical experience, because music should not be judged in the universal standard. But if under very high pressure, you still can be totally focused only on music, enjoying music, while knowing that people are judging you, and not to care about that, then you've achieved something great.
Often after their final round, some contestants are heard saying, "Thank God that's over."
No, that's just not my personality.
What is part of his personality is a sensibility that's far older than his years. Numerous critics have commented on that. One of the main pieces he took to the Clyburn competition was Chopin's deepest, least characteristic, most expressively diverse works, that melange of eloquent fragments known as his Preludes, Opus 28. Conventional strategy would suggest that he plays something safer and flashier.
I don't see it like a risk. I think, first of all, I think it's not about risk. It's about what you love to do. I love to play the preludes in the competition, so it's not a risk for me. If it's something I don't like to do, just I think that will impress people or something, then that's a different story. But I don't think in that case I would do it. But I simply playing the preludes, it's a piece. It's a set of pieces that I love to play. All the pieces in the competition are pieces I love to play.
Haochen Zhang began playing at age 3. Neither of his parents are very musical. His dad is in the garment business. And while they encouraged him to practice every day, they didn't really push. He describes himself as having been a naughty child, a bit hard to imagine now, but discovered that the one place where he could manage to sit still was the piano bench. Certain gifts were immediately apparent, starting with his hands. The fingers are long and thin, especially the pinky, which can give the treble voices a special ping. He rather enjoys looking at his hands.
When I see it, I feel like, how can these 10 fingers express what I really feel about? Something that cannot be expressed, even by words. So that's how I feel like, oh, this really connects to my personality. I mean, it's connected.
By age 5, he was playing his first full recital, and at age 6 made his orchestral debut. Soon, he was following in the footsteps of Long Long, first winning the International Tchaikovsky Competition for Young Musicians in China, and then progressing on to the Curtis Institute, where he studied under Long Long's teacher, Gary Graftman. But he's a far cry from Long Long, most obviously in terms of flamboyance and, truth be told, charisma. Graftman describes him as having a great range in what he does best. Also, Zhang thinks a lot. So, as much as Long Long has raised awareness of Chinese musicians in America or showed the Chinese what they could achieve abroad, he wasn't Zhang's role model. He even wonders if the Chinese pianist phenomenon might have happened anyway, Long Long only speeding up the process.
Of course, before Long Long was famous, I already decided to be a professional musician. So that's without question. But I don't know about the Curtis Institute, because Long Long's success did make me really want to go here. Either way, I'm going to be a musician. I'm going to love music in the same way. That's not going to be different.
What Haochen Zhang didn't anticipate was the extent of his solitude. 6 months after arriving in America at age 14, his mother, who accompanied him, was unable to renew her visa and had to go home. Aside from his host families, Zhang has been pretty much alone and had to make friends with solitude. Even his classes are independent studies. Yeah, he plays concerts while writing and researching term papers on the road, says Jonathan Cooper Smith, chairman of academic studies at Curtis.
I think it's extremely difficult, and it's not for everybody. Maybe he'll grow up sooner than others, but he seems to be doing well, as far as I can tell. Sometimes I wish he'd slow down and enjoy himself more, but I think that's just his personality.
The world really doesn't need another flashy, super impressive competition winner. What is needed is more pianists like Mitsuko Uchida, who lost one competition after another but slowly built her career on Mozart. But the question is, in this information-saturated age, is it even possible for Haochen Zhang to hold back until he's ready? YouTube already has some 45 videos on him, some of which he barely knows about. One dates back to his preteen years in China. Another is shot in a humble lecture hall with him playing on a small spinet piano. It's nice to have that level of public interest. But how can he hope to accurately represent himself as an artist if the information superhighway is already speeding him away?
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Haochen Zhang performs Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1 with the Philadelphia Orchestra at the Mann Center on Tuesday evening. The program also features Beethoven's Symphony No. 9. Gritty TV dramas like Law & Order pride themselves on lurid plots that are ripped from the headlines. But basing fiction on true crimes is anything but new. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores how a Philadelphia author drew on a notorious rape and murder case to create the most scandalous bestseller of the 1840s.
In 1844, a Philadelphia writer named George Lepard published a novel called The Quaker City, or The Monks of Monk Hall. Lepard's sprawling story blended the occult, social criticism, extreme gore, and mild pornography to portray a grotesque Philadelphia that was a cesspool of vice and immorality. But LaSalle University professor Edward Pettit suggests that this fantastic novel was a disturbingly accurate vision of the real Quaker City.
The best way to describe Philadelphia then is imagine Philadelphia today and then imagine it without police. Because that's basically what you had at the time. I think there was a riot in the city, a major riot in Philadelphia every year from 1837 to 1845. Abolition halls were burned down, churches were burned down, there were a lot of anti-Catholic riots. So it's a dark, tough place to live in at the time.
Building on this bleak reality, Lepard created a novel which grows grimmer from page to page. Everyone in the Quaker City is willing to sacrifice their loved ones to achieve their own goals. At one point, a character imagines the final day of the corrupt metropolis when an earthquake plunges all Philadelphians to their deaths. Lepard's despairing tone may be his reaction to the crime, poverty, and chaos of his era, says James Green, librarian at the Library Company of Philadelphia.
Lepard saw the breakdown of the social order in the 1830s and 1840s in Philadelphia in terms that were very different from those we would see today. I think that he expressed much of this in this almost biblical language of outrage and prophecy, and so that's why there's an apocalyptic tone about the Quaker City. Basically, the day of judgment is at hand.
Despite this darkness, the Quaker City became the most popular novel America had ever seen, not to be outsold until Uncle Tom's Cabin nearly a decade later. The Quaker City's heart of darkness is Monk Hall, a brothel where Philadelphia's male elite gathers to drink and deflower virgins. The protagonist, Arlington, accompanies his best friend, Lorimer, to Monk Hall to watch Lorimer seduce an innocent young girl. Too late, Burnwood discovers that the victim is his own sister, Mary. Insane with rage, Burnwood shoots Lorimer to death on a boat crossing the Delaware River. Ed Pettit believes that Philadelphians gobbled up this story because Lepard had simply changed the names in the biggest local scandal from the previous year.
Malin Hutchinson Heberton met Singleton Mercer's younger sister, Sarah. I think Sarah was 16 at the time, out on the street one day, and Heberton raped her. I mean, he brought her to a house and he raped her. So she came back to the house and then she told the whole story to her mother. And then her brother, Singleton, went ballistic.
For a young girl of good family in the 19th century, the loss of virginity was a fate worse than death. Heberton refused to either marry Sarah or fight a duel with her brother Singleton, claiming they were his social inferiors. But when a drunken Singleton began to stalk his sister's rapist with a loaded pistol, Heberton decided to escape on the next ferry to Camden.
And little did he know, Singleton Mercer had hid himself on the ferry as well and came out and shot him and killed him. The resulting trial was a major event, and Mercer was acquitted, not guilty by reason of insanity, that he had gone crazy because his sister had been so dishonored, so he was not really responsible for his actions.
1 year later, the Quaker City appeared. Singleton Mercer's reaction to the book is unknown. But when Lepard attempted to mount a dramatized version at the Chestnut Street Theater, Mercer didn't hold back. He and a group of friends stormed the box office, bought 200 tickets, and threatened to burn down the theater on opening night. The play was canceled. A decade later, at age 32, George Lepard was dead, and his books soon to be forgotten.
He went on to write a dozen novels, was a major labor crusader, founded one of the first labor organizations in the country, was a crusading journalist, had his own newspapers. It's been estimated that he wrote and published 1 million words per year for 10 years. His works veered between this lurid sensationalism, but behind it all, he's trying to cure the ills of society.
Sarah Mercer would live down her public shame and marry not once, but twice before dying in 1860 at the age of 33. But her brother's life unraveled after the publication of The Quaker City, despite his acquittal.
Singleton Mercer kind of disappears for several years, and the only mention of him is about 10 years or so later, he's in a bar brawl, and then later he's may perhaps undergo some kind of epiphany in his life, and he goes off to become a nurse to help yellow fever victims.
In August 1855, Singleton Mercer was sent to Portsmouth, Virginia, a city ravaged by the disease. Within a month, a 35-year-old volunteer died of fever himself. After moldering in a Virginia grave for 4 years, the bodies of Mercer and 8 other local volunteers were disinterred and returned to Philadelphia. Today, the acquitted murderer rests beneath a marble column in a hero's tomb at Laurel Hill Cemetery. On one side is a carving of the Good Samaritan, and the biblical quotation,
"Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends."
About 100 yards south of the yellow fever victims monument here at Laurel Hill is a much smaller stone, almost swallowed up by the earth. It's the grave of Malin Heberton Hutchinson, moved here in 1848 when his Center City Church closed its doors. Today, only a short walk separates the final resting places of 2 young men whose shattered lives became the grist for Victorian America's most notorious novel.
WRTI's Tom Keels with the second of a 5-part series called Wicked Philadelphia, which will be running throughout the summer. A companion book to these features is out now on the History Press imprint. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.